Hi, I'm Moshe, and I'm autistic.
I'm Leah, and I'm boring.
Welcome to Now You Know One Autistic,
a podcast about neurodiversity in couples, marriage, meltdowns, and making it all work.
The opinions expressed in this podcast reflect the experience of one couple and one autistic.
Nothing that you hear in this podcast should be taken as a medical opinion. And unless otherwise stated, no one is an accredited specialist in any of the many fields that comprise the autism spectrum.
But as someone who is on the autism spectrum, I feel that my experiences will be very valuable to many of you. Whether you're on the spectrum, a support person like Leah, or just a curious bystander.
If you think that you or someone you care about may be autistic, consult your family doctor. Hi, Moshe.
Hi, Leah.
How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
All right, so now we're picking up part two of communicating about communication.
Yeah, part two, communication about communication. We did the first part, not last time, but the time before that, and it went a little bit long. And that's okay, because people are listening to us talk, and if we can't always be, you know, less verbose, then sometimes more is better than not at all.
That's perfectly okay, because they were very interesting topics and we had a lot to go into about them. So we left you last time with a little bit info about what we wanted to cover in this episode. However, we realized that when we were doing the topic of communication styles, we didn't necessarily thoroughly go into it. So Moshe wanted to go over a little bit about examples of the communication styles that we discussed last time.
Right. So the last episode of communication, we discussed the four different kinds of communication styles. And I had mentioned at the end that there were some really good examples, but I couldn't think of them. So I actually looked them up, and there were a few things, and we'll briefly go over them before we get into the topics today. So first, the different sorts of communication styles that Leah basically went into are the passive, assertive, passive aggressive, and aggressive. And in particular, what I was really interested in was, what is the difference between an aggressive speaker and an assertive speaker?
A lot of people struggle with that, neurotypical or neurodivergent.
So the brief summary is, I'll quickly kind of go over the overview. It defines a passive speaker as emotionally dishonest, indirect, inhibited, self-denying, blaming, and apologetic.
Ooh, dishonest? That's harsh.
Emotionally dishonest. A passive-aggressive speaker is emotionally dishonest as well, indirect, self-denying at first, and self-enhancing at the expense of others later. An aggressive speaker is inappropriately honest, direct, expressive, attacking, blaming, controlling, and self-enhancing at the expense of others. Appropriately honest is how you start off: assertive. Appropriately honest, direct, self-enhancing, expressive, self-confident, and empathetic to the emotions of all the people that are involved.
Right. So I would actually say that the aggressive description describes sort of, if you looked up or if you saw on a popular TV show an autistic person, how they would be perceived of communicating.
So the main definition between assertive and aggressive, because a lot of people, they go, what's the difference between assertive and aggressive? So some examples that they give are: aggressive means you establish one's needs and beliefs in a threatening and disrespectful way, whereas an assertive person shows up and supports one's beliefs without disrespecting others. An aggressive person is overconfident, which leads to harshness. An assertive person is confident and self-assured. An aggressive person is manipulative, hostile, demeaning, and abusive, whereas an assertive person would be direct, persuasive, honest, and open. An aggressive person would be rigid, arrogant, and rude, whereas an assertive person would be flexible and firm, but also soft. An aggressive person would never admit mistakes. An assertive person admits their mistakes. An aggressive person pushes their agenda forcefully. An assertive person has an agenda that they share by understanding other people's agenda. And an aggressive speaker, their goal is to disrespect others, whereas an assertive person, their goal is to keep everyone happy. Mm-hmm. So we'll go into an example that people give. It's the same scenario in all four examples. And the scenario is, a manager works in an office and he has to get some figures from his assistant, John. So passive person might say, so no problem, Joan, you can get those figures to me whenever you want. Mm-hmm. Passive aggressive person would say, you know, Joan, things would run a lot more smoothly if people just got their reports in on time. An aggressive person would say, Joan, if you don't get me those numbers soon, there's going to be a lot of doc pay around here. And an assertive person would be like, hey, Joan, I know you're really busy, but I need to get those numbers to me by Friday at noon.
Right.
So that is the main difference in those communication styles. You're asking for something, but the difference between an aggressive and an assertive speaker is, on one hand, the aggressive speaker makes threats to get what they want. They're very forceful. They're very pushy. An assertive person is still, you know, assertive, for lack of a better word, but they also do it in a way that respects the other person. You're still telling Joan, I need those numbers. But instead of saying, hey, if you don't give me those numbers, I'm going to dock your pay, you're saying, I get that you're really busy, but it's really important that you get those to me on time, please. That's the difference.
Right. So which of those examples of how the manager handled Joan do you think is the healthiest? I'm asking Moshe, but I'm also asking the audience at large, truthfully.
So the problem with each of these communication styles, except for assertive, is in the event of the passive speaker, you are actually being very respectful of the other person, but at the expense of yourself. You're saying, I don't really mind, get those to me whenever. You do mind, but you're not actually going to tell her. So on one hand, you're going to feel resentment.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, Joan is going to be like, oh, okay, I guess it's not a big deal. I'll get them into you, whatever.
Right. And at the end of the quarter, when you give her a bad review, she's not going to understand.
I don't understand. I thought you said that you didn't mind.
Exactly.
Passive aggressive is definitely the most dangerous, in my opinion, because essentially what you're doing is you're indirectly asking for something, because it denotes essentially that nobody's happy here, because you are unhappy because for whatever reason, you don't have the numbers you need. And Joan's going to be unhappy because she's like, yeah, are you trying to ask me to do something? And this is actually a situation that autistic people and neurodivergent people often struggle with. Because if you take somebody at their word, then you have to assume that when something is said, it is said because it denotes a need. And if someone were to walk into the kitchen, for example, and there's dishes on the counter, you might say, gosh, it would be really nice if someone could do the dishes. And then half an hour, we go see Ryan. You go, why didn't you do the dishes yet? And she's like, you didn't ask me to. And you'd be like, yeah, I did. I said it would be nice if someone to do the dishes. That's your cue. And she would rightfully say, I didn't know that you were asking me to do them. And then an aggressive person would essentially, the passive aggressive, nobody's happy. The person you're talking to doesn't know what you actually want. And the person who is talking feels unsatisfied by what they're asking for. It's a lose-lose situation. An aggressive person, what you're doing is you are satisfying yourself by putting the other person down. So you're happy, they're not happy. And they could rightfully say to you, if you wanted me to do the dishes, you could have just said so. You don't have to be mean about it. You don't have to yell. You don't have to be angry. If you need something done, just tell me you need it done. You would go into the kitchen and be like, I asked you to do the dishes like 2 hours ago and they're still not done. There's going to be serious consequences. We're not going to do anything. You're not going to get to go out. It's going to be a whole thing. Now, the difference between that and assertive is, okay, you know what? The dishes have been waiting there for a while. I see that you're really tired today and I see that you're busy. I really need those dishes to be done so that I can make supper. Would you be able to do that, please? Mm-hmm.
More often than not, unless I'm really fed up, that's how I'll approach it. Two things come to mind just during your explanation. The first is how many people in my life in particular are very aggressive communicators. It's almost disturbing, truthfully. And secondly, you brought up false confidence or overconfidence. Over false confidence, that is an issue. I find not necessarily with neurotypical versus neurodivergent, but with a certain personality type, like an A-type personality, people will have overconfidence and it's false confidence. It's based in nothing. Tell me about your experiences with that.
See, the overconfidence and the over false confidence are different because you can be overconfident. Maybe you are very good at something and you're not taking into other people's account. So let's say you're really, really good at, I don't know, stacking boxes. You can be like, I can stack 50 boxes in an hour. And you can't. You're very good at boxes, but you're not that fast, let's say. Whereas over false confidence is essentially, you don't actually think that you can stack very many boxes at all, but you say you can because you don't believe in yourself. You're actually denoting or demeaning yourself by expressing something to make, I don't know, maybe your aim is to make people feel better. Maybe it's to make you feel better. Maybe it's to placate someone. But when you have to, when you know that you're boosting yourself up falsely, then you're actually indicating that you have very low self-esteem and a low belief in yourself.
What about when people boost themselves up falsely, but they don't know it's false? They genuinely think they're the best, I don't know, astronaut on the planet or something.
Those are very difficult people to deal with because what you need to do in those cases is if you don't really care that much, you can be like, all right, whatever, sure, you're the greatest. You invented everything that's ever been invented. Or if you want to challenge that or you want to help the person, say it's someone that you genuinely love or want to help in their ability to be a better, more functional person, you can be like, okay, I'm really glad that you can wash dishes in 5 minutes. So let's see if you can do them. Let's go ahead. Show me what you can do.
Right. And that's a lot of times where I'm at with people. They'll say, I did the blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh yeah, show me.
And it becomes very difficult. And unfortunately, a lot of these people have some other things going on sometimes.
You mean like the people who genuinely believe their overconfidence?
Yes.
Yeah. So a lot, I guess they have mental health issues or something. That's something I'm not willing to dive into because we don't even have a lot of life experience with that.
For sure.
However, if any viewers out there or listeners, sorry, out there do, they can absolutely let us know.
Yeah. So that is a great way to segue into the first, or rather the next topic in our communication.
This is a very interesting topic, Moshe. I think I say that about every topic.
Yes.
People are going to start making fun of me again. Maybe it'll be a merchandise.
This is the best.
It's the best, Moshe. Best. We're laughing because everything in Israel is super. It's not just, you know, a pharmacy. It's a super farm. It's not just a grocery store. It's super grocery.
Yes, they're not just a great doctor. They're the best doctor that's ever doctored ever.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to be discussing the double empathy problem. It's a very interesting problem that you can do quite a deep dive into if you choose to. So let's see where this goes and how much time you spend on it.
Okay.
The definition that I found while I was researching it is people with very different life experiences or who experience the world differently. When they interact with one another, they will struggle to empathize with one another. These are often exacerbated by difference in language and comprehension. It leads to a mutual breakdown of communication.
Right. So the graphic that I have here denotes the problem between a neurodivergent or an autistic person, say, and a non-autistic person. And it's exactly what you said. The both parties will struggle to understand each other's thoughts, feelings, behavior, and differences. And one of the main issues that every one of those people has to struggle with is individualized based on where they stand. The autistic person often struggles to see nuance. An autistic person often struggles to overcome other people's misconceptions.
Mm-hmm.
The autistic person may struggle to manage sensory distractions, whereas the neurotypical or holistic or whatever, they struggle to form positive first impressions. They may struggle to recognize and understand the autistic, and they may struggle to imagine autistic sensory difficulties. And this is really, 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 really important as it defined the beginning of our relationship.
It defines a lot of relationships. So if you look just at the definition that I, I spoke, right? Different experiences of the world. Between autistic and holistic people, they experience the world vastly differently, even if they're in the same exact situation. Struggling with language.
Right.
You know, it's one of the hallmarks of autism to struggle with language, even if you're speaking the same language, which can make it very confusing and frustrating for people. And also different comprehension of things, where an autistic will tend to take things very literally. Like, you like to give the example of Amelia Bedelia.
Yeah.
They told her to make the bed. An holistic child might just throw their covers on the bed, where she went and she got the wood and the hammer and the tools and she was making a bed.
Right.
So even differences in comprehension. So that leads itself to unbelievable misunderstandings. And it's literally nobody's fault, because you're saying the thing as honestly as you possibly can say it. I'm saying the thing as honestly as I possibly can say it. But the words are not meaning the same thing to the other person.
Right. Because when you are neurodivergent, oftentimes you are said to struggle with empathy. And that is actually, our experience is that's actually not what. Autistic people don't struggle necessarily with empathy. They struggle with double empathy, which is the phenomenon or the problem of understanding another person's experiences. It's not that they don't care a lot of the time. It's that they don't understand what they're supposed to be caring about.
Exactly. So, for example, I don't know, a Tylenol commercial with puppy dogs in it might make me cry and sad. It doesn't mean that Moshe doesn't have empathy for the puppy dogs, or he doesn't have empathy for me, who's sad about the puppy dogs. It's just that puppy dogs don't make him feel that way. So he has no frame of reference for understanding why I'm feeling that way. So he would rightly say, why are you crying? Why are you feeling that way? That doesn't even make sense. And that would come off as definitely sort of lacking empathy. Do you agree with that? Exactly.
It's not that I don't care. It's that I don't. Number one, I might not understand why you care, and I don't understand necessarily why I should care, except that you see, it's essentially something that I've described many times, which is, I don't understand why this upsets you, but I love you, so I'm upset that you're upset.
The reality is, if you break it down, a lot of the times, it isn't even something you should care about. It's just that at large, it's expected, if that makes sense.
Exactly.
What we discovered too long into our relationship, if you ask me, but what we discovered is there's a reason why it's called the double empathy problem. It goes in both directions. There were things that would upset Moshe that I would not understand. Till this day, I still don't understand, because I have no frame of reference for those things to be upsetting me. It does go both ways. And if you looked at it from his perspective, then I would be lacking empathy.
Exactly. So let's discuss some examples of the double empathy problem. And again, I want to emphasize that even though we're discussing it from the perspective of an autistic or neurodivergent person and a non-autistic or holistic person, it can happen in any relationships, and it happens a lot of the time. But it's particularly remarkable in that it falls into another category that we may or may not discuss it at a certain point in the future, which is the you should know this then.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to discuss that.
Which I have a lot of issues with, because the you should know this thing is a very, it's a very interesting situation. Because a lot of these things, once again, as with many neurodivergent qualities and characteristics, it comes with development and experience and maybe perspective into maybe something instinctual, which an autistic person or a neurodivergent person often may lack. Something that happens to me a lot, actually, is the understanding, and this is one of the most common differences between an autistic and a non-autistic, but it also happens with people who struggle with mental illness and people who don't. Because what it looks like is, it looks like an example of diminishing a person's experiences. And what they're doing is they're attempting to relate, but by relating, they're coming across as condescending. And an example of that is, I will say, because I am autistic. You knew that, right?
Yes, I did.
I am autistic, and one of my sensitivities is sound sensitivities. So occasionally, particularly very high-pitched sounds will cause me to cover my ears or become very agitated. And I will say something like, I have a sound sensitivity because I'm autistic. And then a person will go, yeah, I don't like loud noises either. Or, you know, I'll say, I have a processing delay because I'm autistic. And they'll say, yeah, sometimes it's hard for me to make up my mind too. And they're completely innocent in their ability to try and relate to you. But in doing that, they're essentially reducing your experience. In the same way that you're telling somebody, I don't know, someone who's struggled their whole life with, let's say, major depression, and being told, you know, sometimes when I'm sad, I just smile and I feel better.
Right, exactly.
Maybe, have you tried, you know, just
have you thinking tried happy thoughts?
Have you tried smiling more?
Like the diet culture. Have you tried eating less?
Yeah. I struggle with, you know, body image. Well, you know.
Have you tried eating less and going to the gym?
Exactly.
Yeah. I understand exactly what you're talking about there. And a lot of times these suggestions or advice comes unsolicited.
For sure. And it is extremely unfortunate that a lot of this difficulty with understanding neurodivergent person often comes from the autistic person or the neurodivergent person's caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are the parent of an autistic person, then oftentimes you will become an autistic champion, say, and be like, my son or my daughter is autistic. So let me tell you what you need to know about what being autistic means. And meanwhile, the autistic person is just kind of sitting there being like, I guess they're an expert now.
Right. But that's still better than the alternative of not understanding at all. It comes from a good place.
Sometimes.
I think a lot of the time it does.
Sometimes it does. And you see this a lot, actually, because, again, as I mentioned in a previous episode, I spend a lot of time on autistic boards because I kind of want to know what exactly the parents of autistics and people who have autism are thinking about and struggling with, and what are some issues that maybe we should talk about in a future episode, and maybe some commonalities. And what I see time and time and time again is these things that make the person come across like they're the parent of Superman or this new form of life that nobody has ever seen. And again, it absolutely comes from a fantastic place, I'm sure. And they're absolutely trying to come across to boost their child. But in doing so, they're essentially giving them an otherness, which will harm them in the long run. My son is a superhero. You know what he did today? He washed a dish.
That makes me so upset.
You know, he is my favorite person in the whole world because he put on his pants properly today, and he only threw up twice when he ate a food he didn't like.
So I think what Moshe is saying here is that he's not trying to minimize the struggles of people who have issues with putting on their pants correctly or throwing up when they eat a trigger food. What he's trying to say is that you're minimizing your expectation of another human being when you treat it that way.
Right.
You would never say that to a neurotypical person. Like, yay, you got out of bed today. Congratulations.
Right. And if you did, it would come across as condescending and patronizing.
Because people, regardless, when you set a bar for them, they reach it. And if you set the bar too low, that's all they're ever going to reach, unless they're a very specific type of person.
Yeah, you don't want to set the bar too high, because then essentially you're setting up your child for failure. And again, we're going to do whole episodes just dealing with autistic children and things that autistic children struggle with and parents of autistic children. But in particular, if you set the bar too high, then you're essentially setting yourself up for failure, for being disappointed. And if you set the bar too low, then you're limiting your child's potential, because being autistic does not mean that they are non-functional, not necessary.
Right. The only time you should clap for somebody having put their pants on as if they were in a coma previously.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the expectation needs to be set that not only is this not something special, it's something that they should be doing anyway. If it's, I mean, and again, that having been said, I'm not trying to diminish or limit the struggle.
We're going to hear from the parents who said, well, my son couldn't put his pants on for a year and then he finally accomplished it. Great. And that's wonderful. What are you working on next?
Right. You can tell the child, you know what, buddy, you did a great job. Your pants are on straight. Let's keep doing that.
Now, how about work on your shirt buttons?
Let's figure out your buttons. Like, but don't like make a whole parade in town square over the fact that your child put on their pants properly, because that's the minimal expectation.
There is an adult TikToker. I don't want to bring it up right now. It's going to be brought up eventually, but I don't want to bring it up right now who it is. But there is an adult TikToker who was a full-on adult, and their parent just congratulates them for the most ludicrous of things. And it's just, it's uncomfortable, to be honest with you.
For sure.
It feels like going to Marineland and watching the dolphins perform.
We're going to talk about this person quite a bit in this podcast, because it's actually one of the impetuses that I had for wanting to do the podcast in the first place. And I would very much like to involve them in the podcast in a future episode. If there's all, we'll move on.
Their caregiver doesn't even let them do their own media, but it doesn't matter anyway. I want to bring us back to a point you made when we first started discussing the double empathy problem, because people, I guess, like to hear examples that you could get off the internet or general examples, but they're here to listen to us. So you said this was a huge problem at the beginning of our relationship. Let's talk about that a little bit.
So double empathy is frustrating. And again, as Leia said, from both ends, because so much, as I said in, I think, the first episode, so much time is spent trying to discuss how autistic people struggle to relate, or how neurotypical people struggle to relate to autistic people. But not a lot of emphasis or not a lot of time is spent on looking at it from the other perspective, on how an autistic person often struggles to understand or relate or empathize with a neurotypical. And when you have a situation or a sensitivity or a limitation or a struggle, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, that is mundane or normal or basic or even strange, then it's hard to understand not just why you need to do it, but why it matters to you. And the one that I will use over and over and over again is my most common one, which is, as an autistic person, one of the things that I struggle with a lot is understanding my own emotions. I went through a lot of struggles, especially early on, where I was said to have anger issues, and I was said to have depression, and I was said to, you know, not know how to emotionally regulate myself, and I would, you know, push people. There's a lot of problems. So emotional expression and emotional understanding was a challenge for me for a lot of my life. And so one of my own ways of dealing with it, especially with Leia, is to use her brain or functionality, I guess, to better understand appropriateness. So I will go to her and I will say, this thing makes me very sad. And she will say, okay, so what do you want to do? And I said, I don't want to do anything. I just want it to be acknowledged that it makes me sad. And for a long time, she struggled with that. She says, why? If you don't want anything done about that, why do you talk about it? Why do you bring it up? Why do you express it?
Mm-hmm. And I was like, good for you, I guess.
And that was a challenge. And I explained to her that for me, it's like you're handing this broken thing, this small, you know, whatever it is, this inanimate emotional bubble to a person that you care about and you trust, and you put it in their hands and you go, you know, can you take this from me and do something with it? And a lot of the time, what you want done with it is just acknowledgement. And the reaction comes across as patronizing, because a neurotypical oftentimes doesn't need to have something acknowledged and then just left. It would actually come across as callous or patronizing.
Yeah, it's a thing that you're actually taught never to do. So for example, when somebody says, I'm really upset at you for doing the blah, 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 You're never supposed to say, I'm sorry you felt that way.
Right.
Ever, because that is shirking responsibility and that's making sort of them responsible for their feelings, but you didn't do anything.
Right.
So it was actually a thing you were asking me to do that is contrary to everything that we're taught about.
Right. And the reason that Leia is the person that I approach is because I love her and I trust her. And I'm taking something that I struggle with, which is an emotion, and I'm putting it in her hands. And I'm saying, look at it. Look at this poor sad emotion, or look at this poor angry emotion. And the reaction I'm looking for is, oh, this is such a sad little emotion. And then I can go, yeah, it is, isn't it? And then I feel better.
Mm-hmm. I know it sounds absolutely bonkers to a lot of you out there. It might make sense to some of you out there. I'd actually like to hear from other people who have this phenomenon. But I have always been taught that apologies with no action mean nothing. I've always been taught that you're not supposed to say, I'm sorry you feel that way. You're supposed to say, I'm sorry I did the thing. So it was a high learning curve for me because I was like, honey, I'm so sorry you're upset about that. Now, what do you want me to do with this? And there was literally zero.
Exactly. And
he'd be like, I don't know. Give me a hug.
Right. So it's the minimum effort for the maximum outcome. Because a lot of the time, I still would love to be able to shed more light on it because it's a fascinating principle. But for me, it's really about the fact that I've struggled often in my life with understanding my own emotions. And so what I'm really saying is, this thing is sadness, right? And she'll go, yeah, it's sadness. I'll go, oh, okay, thank you. It helps me feel more safe and secure in having a feeling. Because sometimes I'll react a certain way and it will be related to something completely unrelated. Mm-hmm. Emotional dysregulation and emotional misidentification. I'm really upset, and so I'm going to do something that's not related to being upset. I don't pick a thing.
Whereas the way that I work and a lot of other neurotypicals tend to work, as far as I know, is that if you're upset about a thing, once the thing is resolved, the upset goes away.
Right.
Because there's no thing to be upset about anymore, so why be upset?
Now, this actually works in reverse too, because it's not so dissimilar from something that a lot of neurotypicals do in relationships, where they will sit down with their partner at dinner, or they will come to bed and go, oh, that person at work today made me so upset. They did the whatever, and then they asked for a thing, and then I was feeling this, and I did that, and it was just awful. I had such a bad day because of this person. And when you talk to an autistic person, you generally, they're looking for an answer. They're looking for expression. They're looking for a thing. And a concept that is similar to that, but not something that we are very good at doing, is acknowledgement. And again, it sounds completely contradictory because on one hand, I'm asking for acknowledgement, but on the other hand, they're looking for an acknowledgement. And
yes, but what I'm wanting acknowledged is far more complex. And you may not have thought the entire thing through in order to acknowledge it correctly.
Right.
What you're asking for is this sad? Yeah, it's sad. Okay. That's a very simple thing. Whereas this person asked me for this thing. Why is it? Why are you upset about that, Leia? Well, it might be because I told you six other times that person asked me for it and it's not my job. Right. You haven't yet calculated that part.
Exactly. It becomes a very complex scenario. And the end of that story is, I don't actually want you to do anything. I just want you to go, yeah, that Carol is such a bad person.
Just agree with the person. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas for an autistic, I can see where that's hard because it's like, what am I agreeing with? I'm not in the situation. I have no idea.
Yes, I wasn't there. How do I know that she was? I know that you feel that way, but why is the result that you're looking for me to acknowledge that that person is a bad person.
Right. Because I said so, and you have to agree with me. And that's a concept that you struggled with a lot.
You just want agreement. You want understanding. But it's a very difficult concept, and empathy in that sense is hard because I have no frame of reference. I mean, maybe if I know the person, I can go, yeah, I know. The last time that, this happened, this happened too.
Now, that brings up a topic that we also acknowledged again today, but we discussed a long time ago, which is agreeing, always backing up your partner, agreeing with them in public, even if you know they're wrong, and talking to them about it later.
Yes. That is a very, again, a very difficult concept for autistics, because they are autistic people. And again, I want to just roll back and go, I say it's a difficult concept for autistics, not because I'm saying that all autistics struggle with it, but because oftentimes this comes up. Mm-hmm. It's a, if you will, a stereotype that they're very factual. If you feel like a person is not correct, then it is the instinct of them to go, actually, that's not what happened. And what we fail to grasp is it doesn't matter.
Right. It doesn't matter that that's what happened exactly. This is how it made me feel. And that's what I'm telling you about.
Right.
I think this actually goes back to a point where one of our friends, actually, who we're pretty good friends with now, said something that bothered me. And you were like, why does it bother you? And I was like, it bothers me because it does. And now it bothers you too, mister. And it was a fight.
Because if I don't understand the reason for a person to be upset or angry, and when I hear it back, I still don't understand it, then the default needs to be just, we can talk about it, but just in public say, yeah, you were out of line doing that thing. And then later go, why were you upset about that? Like, why was she out of line? I don't understand.
But that is the thing. You always have to be open to that private discussion later, or else it does cause issues. So all of that is to say, in summarize, that the beginning of our relationship was rough.
It was.
It was hours and hours and hours of miscommunications and sort of yelling at each other in the same language, but a different language, to just come to the conclusion that we were saying the same thing to each other, really.
This is to say that communication is,
I mean, our romantic relationship at this point. Again, we'll probably have to do a small episode explaining this whole thing.
We intended, when we went through all the episode ideas that we were thinking about, that we were going to do an episode that's exclusively dealing with some of the more difficult times in our relationship and sort of talking about it in an open and honest way.
Because the reality is, for any relationship, when you move from a friendship, which is very close and very nice, to a romantic relationship, the stakes get very high. The exponential growth of the stakes between you two is scary for anyone. And if you're having communication issues, it's hard. It's really hard.
So what is...
So I have a note here. It's really funny. Sometimes I make myself laugh. All it says is double autism, ? And I don't really remember the reference, but I feel like we were going to explore the idea of the double empathy problem between two autistics, because theoretically they should be able to understand each other better. But there are times where you'll tell Avram something and he'll take it so literally that it's not even what you said.
Yes. And it's kind of almost a humorous comedy of errors, if you will, because Avram and I connect best when we're both acting autistic, but we connect the worst when I am attempting to act how I perceive as normal. Because when you shut down the parts of your mind that allow you to understand things that are oftentimes nonsensical or subtle, then you're preventing yourself from being able to understand the curiosities that are going on with the autistic mind. And oftentimes Avram will look at me and go, "This, you're feeling this way because of this, right?" And I'm like, yeah. And sometimes Avram will say something and I'll be like, "This is why he's saying this." And it turns out that I'm right, because I can notice things and I can detect things and I can perceive things that other people might not be looking for necessarily.
Right. But I feel like what we're discussing here, or what I was trying to discuss, is the opposite. So where even you two won't understand each other necessarily.
And we won't.
So I think maybe the other day you asked him to put his shoes on.
Yes.
And in your mind, that included putting his socks on.
Yes.
And he just put his shoes on. And you were like, socks? And he was like, you didn't say socks.
Right.
And to me, I was like, oh, look, that was sort of double autism right there.
Double autism. Because I'll say a thing without any, you know, descriptors. And he'll do a thing based on how he interpreted what I said and took it completely literally. And a lot of the time, it becomes a problem. And it creates a lot of humorous situations where you would look at the situation and go, well, you should know better than to do the thing.
It is. If any of the major networks wants to pick up, you know, our sitcom, it would be very funny.
It would be a very interesting situation that deals specifically with autistic people misunderstanding each other. And it could get very weird. I would definitely, you know, maybe it's the newest sitcom on network television. You know, we put two autistics in a house together and watch what happens. Yes.
So that brings me to misunderstandings. That's a very broad topic, but pretty simple. I think a lot of our podcast in general has been discussing misunderstandings and how they happen. When we have misunderstandings, how do we deal with them?
Misunderstandings often should, at the very least, involve the sentence, what did you mean by that?
Right.
Because I have mentioned to Leah, and I can mention to our audience, that a lot of the things that I say are not actually the things that I necessarily mean, or that the thing that I'm saying is not meant to be taken the way that it would possibly be interpreted as. And you could say, well, why don't you just say what you mean? And the answer is because I am, or I don't necessarily know what I mean, or I'm saying a thing that resembles the thing that I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. And Leah mentioned, I think in a previous episode, that I often use the word adjacent to the word that I'm trying to say. And it becomes, I don't know, is there like an actual condition where you talk in words that are resembling but not entirely like the words you're trying to say?
I believe it's called autism.
Right. Okay.
No, I think actually it may be called aphasia. Don't quote me, but I'd have to look it up.
It's an interesting concept. Because when and I'm trying to think of a specific example recently that I said a thing, but I actually meant the thing adjacent to the thing that I was trying to say. And it can be something as simple as, honey, do you remember where the thing was? And I'll be like, it's in the living room. I mean the kitchen.
Right. Actually, I can't think of your most recent one, but I remember a funny one that my grandmother said once. She was trying to say that her toe was bothering her. And she pointed at her toe and she said, my foot finger is bothering you.
My foot finger.
That kind of thing. The finger of the foot.
My foot finger. That is completely understandable as far as I can see it. Maybe she was neurodivergent.
Maybe.
And a funny thing that I don't know if it's the same thing or not, that used to happen to me at work. I've worked for a long time in call centers. And a lot of the funniest moments, which we will get into, a lot of the funniest moments in our relationship and in my life overall have come with the way that I express myself and the funny things that I end up doing. And one of the funniest things, which actually isn't that uncommon now that I've talked to people about it, is when I would want to put people on hold, I would ask them if I could hold them for a second. And in my mind, it was like, yeah, hold them. You know, can I put you on hold? Can I hold you? It made perfect sense in my mind. I'm asking to hold you. I'm taking hold and I'm applying it to you. So therefore, can I hold you for a second? And people have laughed and they said, well, I mean, I don't know how that's going to work. Or if you really want to, I guess. Or they'll just be like, the joke will just, they'll just be like, what? I don't understand what you mean. But it happens a lot, unfortunately.
Yeah, it does. So ultimately, yes, misunderstandings, asking what did you mean by that, and our favorite word for this podcast, communication about it, clears up a lot of misunderstandings. And it does sound like a lot of work, but it's worth it for the future because the next time the same thing happens, you're ready to go. Like you already know what's happening.
Right. But it does need to be identified. And this is in no way excusing bad behavior. If someone says a thing and then say, what did you mean by that? Well, I meant this. Oh, okay. Or the common thing that a lot of parents will do with their kids, like when they swear, and they'll go, excuse me, you want to try that again? Or you want to say that again? I don't think I heard you. It sounded like you were saying, you know, a bad word.
One of the my favorite things that my father used to actually say, when he would say something ludicrous, he would sort of wiggle the inside of his ear and say, excuse me, I think I had something stupid in my ear.
Yes, I oftentimes have stupid things in my ear.
So that brings us to our next topic of how long does effective communication take?
Well, that's a very difficult topic.
Well, what do you mean in terms of that, right? So the first is, how long in terms of years does it take to learn how to communicate with each other? Or how long does it take to resolve one particular conflict?
Right.
Or how long does it take to communicate an idea? And the reality is, for all of those options, it takes as long as it takes. It takes until. And the reality is, you just have to care enough. If you don't care enough, then you don't have to.
You have to care. And because humans are so often changing and growing and maturing and unfortunately developing, you know, conditions that affect their processing themselves, it really is a lifelong journey, because the way that I communicate now is not the way that I communicated a year ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And it may not be, in fact, it quite likely won't be the way that I communicate in 10 years' time.
And yes, what I said before, I meant both ways. So not just the neurotypical's job to communicate with and understand the neurodivergent, but the other way around. Again, it takes until it takes. And if you don't want to do it anymore, then that's a whole other discussion.
And I mean, certain things will like solidify eventually, because we started off basically constantly misunderstanding each other on a minute by minute basis. And at a certain
point. Do you remember the first time I told you you weren't hugging and kissing me enough?
Yes.
And you said, I bought you a coffee and I'm looking at you. What more do you want?
Yes, exactly. Because that, in my mind, is demonstrating love in the way that I thought was, you know, effective, and it clearly wasn't. Affection is a very difficult topic to talk about.
You're going to get so many do better do emails from this.
Yes, but this
he
is,
does better now.
This is the evolution of myself, and it really is a matter of learning both from both ends. When I do a thing or when I say a thing, she knows that I'm doing this. Or when she says a thing or acts in a certain way or looks a certain way or touches me, I know that she's probably indicating this. But we didn't know that. We were literally blind, deaf, and dumb. Mostly me.
An additional layer of difficulty for Moshe is that I have been known to have, how do I say this without saying it, resting assertive person face.
Yes. The problem with being not the best at learning social cues and reading faces, facial recognition is a common
My face thing. Is hard to read for neurotypicals, though, because when I'm concentrating or not doing anything in particular, I just look angry. It's not my fault. I'm not angry.
And I also have facial things that people have called out. So
we talked about that in the last episode. The Uncanny Valley.
Uncanny
listen to
Valley.
It. Download it and listen to it.
Exactly. So sometimes what I will do with Leia is I will cover her eyes or I'll cover her face, or I'll say to her, are you upset? And she'll like cover her mouth and be like, do my eyes look upset? And if you isolate certain aspects of a person's face, a lot of the time the picture becomes clear. Because if you're trying to read every line and wrinkle and expression in every aspect of a person's face, it's hard work. If you're not very astute at it or you have a deficiency in that, it's a lot of hard work. I mean, I have to understand what your eyes are saying, your face is saying, your mouth is saying, your ears are saying, your forehead is saying. Because everything is different. But if you're like, all right, just look at my eyes and tell me if you think that I'm upset right now. And then the picture goes, oh, I see. No, you're actually, you look like you're happy. Yeah, exactly. That's what is happening. And alternatively, if someone is smiling and you sort of look in their eyes and go, oh, they're not happy. Their smile doesn't go all the way up to their eyes as is often the expression.
I would suffer with that. Speaking of eyes, we're going to talk about everybody's favorite topic now, eye contact.
Yes.
So eye contact is one of those things that as human beings, has come to be very important. It denotes honesty. It denotes connection. There are so many love songs about it. I could have stood there lost in your eyes, blue eyes, hungry eyes. The eyes are very important in terms of communication between
windows of the soul.
Yeah. Neurotypical people, at least. It's also a well-known thing that autistics have the diagnostic criteria. And it's one of those things that people will notice, even if a person is highly masked, they will go, something is not quite right, or something's a little off about that person. What does eye contact mean to an autistic? And I have a little bit of science to throw in there in a bit, just for fun.
You always do. So that is a very common question that a lot of people will talk to autistics about. And they'll ask, one of the most common traits of someone who with autism or a neurodivergent is that they have trouble looking people in the eyes. Why is that? And I can't speak for every autistic. In fact, the podcast kind of indicates that. But my answer to that question is because looking people in the eyes hurts me. And it's a difficult thing to explain. Why does it hurt you? How does it hurt you? What does it make you feel? It makes me feel overstimulated because eyes, I guess the best thing that I can say about it is that eyes are so expressive in terms of emotions and feedback that it is a physical aversion to look at the average person in the eyes. And actually, the story that I told last time during our episode about the Uncanny Valley is when I would work in an office and I would be speaking to a coworker or a manager or whatever, I would, depending on how authoritative they were, I would have difficulty looking at them in the eye because they're, you know, the expression is staring daggers and it really always feels like being stabbed. But if someone was standing over me and like giving me a talking to, I would generally look at the ground because they're the way that they were looking at me hurt me. Whereas if I was talking to a coworker or someone that I was friendly with, I'd be more likely to look them in the eyes, at least sometimes. And the HR complaint that I had against me was a woman said that I was scanning her body, mm-hmm. but really she was talking to me and I was looking at her, finding it painful, looking away and then trying to look at her again. And it really did look like my eyes were going up and down her body. But really what they were doing is eye contact, can't do eye contact, eye contact, can't do eye contact. And once that was identified, I was in the clear, but that was all due to an aversion to eye contact.
Yes. And it's a very kind of sad and sweet because I love, love, love his eyes. Like love them. But we met when we were 7, as I said, and I don't know that I knew the color of his eyes until we were like 15.
Right. But that was as much due to the fact that I kept losing my glasses as I had difficulty making eye contact.
No, but there was just one day when you started looking me directly in the eye. And it didn't occur to me before that you weren't, but I certainly noticed after you were, because right. It was beautiful and it was sweet and it was a connection that we hadn't had before.
And that's not to say that all autistics struggle with it or that all autistics struggle with it to the extent that many do. And I would say that I fall somewhere in the middle in that I can sustain eye contact a lot of the time, not always. With Leia and other people that I'm very close to, it's generally a lot easier for me. But I know that there are some autistics that actually there's this woman that I follow occasionally on Facebook who talks about her experiences as an autistic mom of a neurotypical child. And all of her pictures on Facebook are of her like looking away or looking up or looking down. To the extent, and she told me that people will often ask her if she's blind because she's always like, her eyes are always moving around.
Do you think it might just be easier for certain autistic people to say that they're blind?
I think maybe yes, but the fact is, like, she's not blind. Her vision's fine. It's just when you're looking at something, and interestingly enough, this also applies to the camera. Because if a lot of the time, and again, this is not universal, but a lot of the time, an autistic person who has to stare at a camera lens to take a picture will often have difficulty looking at the camera lens. And the camera is not an eye, really.
Right.
So why do you think?
I think it might actually be that feeling I'm looking at it and it's looking back at me. Because even as a neurotypical, I sometimes get camera shy or camera nervous. I have to talk to myself, especially before I'm being video filmed.
Right.
Like a picture snap is one thing, but I'll still do the whole thing where I sort of like prepare my eyes and I look up in the correct way so my face doesn't look weird and whatever. But before I go on camera to really speak, I feel vulnerable. I feel like it's looking at me. So I can understand that.
I tend to be very charismatic. So people often like to talk to me. And I used to dread doing video interviews because I had a lot of difficulty sustaining them. Because this is something that presumably a lot of people are going to watch, because everyone wants to hear Moshe's opinion. But then you get me on camera and I essentially address the interview to the ceiling. Right. And it's like, okay, maybe like what's wrong with it?
When I did that interview in Victoria for was it a food blog? I don't remember exactly.
It was Shaw TV, I think.
I struggled, and they made it a lot easier because they did it in the interview format. So they put the camera sort of to the side, and then they made me look at the guy who was speaking to me. So I wasn't looking directly to the camera. It is an intimidating thing. And I can't understand why, because there's no actual person in the camera at the time. It just feels like the camera itself is moving.
It does. And some qualities that, because a lot of people will say, especially if they have children, that that don't make eye contact. Because like Leia said, that there's this really inconvenient and I would say unfair perception that a person who isn't looking you in the eyes is being dishonest, is being shifty. And I worked for a company in New Brunswick in Canada, and my manager was always on my case because the lights were really bright, so I had to wear sunglasses. And he said, no, you can't wear sunglasses at work because people can't see your face properly and it doesn't look honest. And I said, okay, well, you know, do I have to, like, people keep saying that you're not looking at them when they're talking to you because you're not paying attention.
It's a tough subject, honestly.
So what some strategies?
Before strategies, let me just quickly go into the science of it.
Absolutely.
It's really interesting.
Take it away.
Thank you. So you can Google these studies yourself, but there have been a couple of recent studies.
I did.
Where they sat a neurotypical person across from an autistic person and they hooked them up to EEG machines and they made them look each other in the eye for as long as they could stand. And what they noticed was that when autistics would look at people in the eye, they would have lower than normal activity in their dorsal parietal cortex. So that's a part of the brain. Not sure what it's responsible for. I'd have to look
that up. I was going to ask you, what's that responsible for?
I don't remember. I would have to look that up. We can possibly put it up on the website. Maybe. And it shows less activity in people with ASD. And the more severe their diagnosis, the lower activity is. So you would think, because autistics often describe everything being too bright, too much, too whatever, that it would be more activity, but it's less. And that interests me on top of that, because people with ADHD used to be given sedatives. And as we know, that's the opposite of what you're supposed to do for ADHD, because their up behavior, their hyper behavior isn't because their brain is doing too much. It's because their brain is doing too little.
Right.
So did you catch, I see Moshe looking it up. What is the dorsal parietal cortex responsible for?
So the according to one paper, the dorsal parietal cortex is responsible for top-down orienting, whereas the ventral parietal cortex is responsible for bottom-up orienting.
So orientation.
So essentially, it's like...
So vestibular orientation.
Yeah, so it's essentially like it controls something to do with knowing, you know, your field of vision. It has to do with the field of vision that goes from the top to the bottom.
Interesting.
I don't know what that means. I don't know what...
Well, I mean, I know that there are more senses than we talk about, and one of them is the vestibular sense, which orientates yourself in space, and autistics often score poorly in that area.
Right.
So again, do your own research, or we can look into it more for you, maybe do a little write-up on our website. Maybe it could be a YouTube video or something.
So just a quick note about that, just because I found it kind of interesting. One of my talents is speed reading. So I can kind of look at a paragraph and go, zip.
It is.
Oh, there's something. So what is top-down orienting mean? And the example they give is go to the produce aisle of your local supermarket. You will notice that a lot of the higher priority items are higher and the less priority ones are lower, because your natural state is to look from the top to the bottom rather than from the bottom to the top. So things that are at the top are more likely to catch your attention than things at the bottom. So, but they determine that interruptions often happen from the bottom to the top. For example, if you're looking at something, your natural state is to look from the top to the bottom. But when you're surprised or interrupted, you actually look from the bottom up. They've discovered a phenomenon that if you annoy someone, if they're like reading a book and you like poke them, they'll actually go like this rather than, you know, because your attention comes from the bottom up, but your focus comes from the top down. So they suspect that it has something to do with attention, with the ability to focus and pay attention to certain things. I don't know. Make of that what you will. If you have any opinions or feelings,
maybe it is exactly the situation you discussed. Somebody's body is essentially just a bunch of body parts. But when you get to the eyes, everybody must admit, you're typical or not, that the eyes are a different thing.
Absolutely.
So it might just be that interruption. It's jarring. They're unlike other parts of the body. Anyway, write to us. Let us know what you think about this. And if you want more of it, we'll figure it out. It seems like we tapped into a more complicated topic than we had initially thought. So all of this is to say, in conclusion, I want to ask, should we insist on eye contact, or should the world just be made to be a bit more accommodating of that situation?
I think that applying values to bodily function is unfair, because everyone is different. And saying that somebody who doesn't make eye contact is dishonest is like saying that somebody who has bad posture is lazy.
Any interrogation investigator will tell you, somebody who is making up a lie will actually look up into the left. So if a person is not looking up into the left, they're likely not lying.
Fair enough. And I've heard that as well. I think that eye contact is not necessarily the be all and end all. There's a lot of different ways, as you said, up into the left to denote that someone's dishonest. And as an interesting conclusion to that, if I'm really paying attention to something with someone talking, I'll actually often close my eyes. Mm-hmm. And that's doubly purpose, because I actually find that reducing the visual stimulation causes me to pay more attention.
And I've seen people be multiple ways on understanding, for sure. But also some people are like, what is wrong with you? And I've seen it happen.
People will say, oh, am I boring you? Oh, you're falling asleep. You're not paying any attention. And actually, I had a counselor, a therapist once, who I was having difficulty at school, and the therapist or whatever came to our house, and I was sitting there listening to what he was saying, and my eyes were closed. And my parent was like, well, look, he's not even paying attention. He doesn't even care about what you're saying. And it was the therapist that looked at me and said, no, actually, he's paying extra attention. He's really listening, because he's closed off his visual input in order to take in better what I'm trying to express. So that is an interesting little anecdote to end on.
So what I'm taking is that your opinion is we shouldn't force eye contact then.
Yes.
That is my opinion as well. Let us know what your opinion is.
Thank you for listening. Well, that's our show for today. Now you know one autistic just a little bit better. So something you may not know about some autistics is that we often struggle with ending social interactions. So, Leia?
All right, Monsha, I'll take care of it. Thank you for listening to Now You Know One Autistic. See you next week.